From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the director and the star of Once Were Warriors, a new film from New Zealand that has broken all box office records there. The film is about Maoris, the indigenous people of New Zealand, who now live in urban ghettos. New York Times film critic Janet Maslin described the film as a brutally effective family drama. Also today, a doctor whose approach to medicine changed after she became a patient. Dr. Jody Hyman tells us why, after emergency brain surgery, she learned that patients usually don't have enough input into their own medical treatment. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a tribute album to Doc Pomus, featuring songs he wrote for Elvis Presley and the Drifters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A judge has sentenced the Long Island commuter gunman to six life terms without parole. Colin Ferguson shot and killed six people and wounded another 19 on the commuter train in December 1993. Ferguson, who represented himself, made a statement before being sentenced. Survivors of the shooting and relatives of the murdered victims got up and walked out together before Ferguson started speaking. Authorities in New Jersey say one person is in custody in connection with yesterday's deadly shooting at a Montclair post office. Officers in East Orange picked up the rather unidentified suspect in a raid on an apartment complex. Four people died in yesterday's shooting, and one person is in critical condition. Officials say it happened during an apparent robbery. House Republican leaders are calling on the nation's business people to help pass the Contract with America. Speaker Newt Gingrich led a discussion of GOP plans in an electronic town hall meeting organized by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
Organizers say as many as 3,000 local chambers of commerce, colleges, and associations tuned in to listen and pose questions. One question sent by fax raised the issue of environmental regulations. Speaker Gingrich said many decisions by the Environmental Protection Agency would be revisited.
They have a proposal for California that would basically close down the California economy. They've had proposals for the inner city that make the Environmental Protection Agency the leading job-killing agency in the federal government. They do more to make it hard to create jobs in inner city America than any other agency.
Gingrich said some Republican lawmakers had been in Washington so long without a break, their resolve was beginning to weaken. He asked for the people listening in to call their congressmen and urge passage of term limits, a Republican tax bill, and welfare reform. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak has called on delegates of the Arab League to make the Middle East free of weapons of mass destruction. NPR's Suni Khaled reports.
President Mubarak told Arab leaders that the very existence of the Arab world could depend on efforts to ban nuclear weapons from the Middle East. The Egyptian leader's appeal came as the 23-member Arab League met to celebrate its 50th anniversary. Mubarak has recently stepped up his campaign to win regional endorsement of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which is up for renewal next month. Israel has refused a recent Egyptian demand to join the NPT, arguing that it will do so only if hostile regimes like Iran, Iraq, and Libya abandon their nuclear ambitions. Egypt and other Arab states have indicated that they may delay extending their acceptance of the treaty until Israel agrees to do so as well. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen more than 5 points to 4,078.49. Trading is very heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq Composite Index has fallen more than a point to 808. This is NPR. President Clinton has signed the new unfunded mandates law. This requires the federal government to do a cost-benefit analysis for regulations imposed on states that cost more than $50 million. Congress must pay state and local governments for any costs above that. The law also permits Congress to kill any imposed regulation that isn't adequately paid for by the federal government. Six wolves that were offered freedom in Wyoming's section of Yellowstone National Park have chosen to stay put for a while. Biologists opened the gates of their holding pen yesterday, hoping the predators would leave. This would mark the historic return of the predator to the range. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
The wolves are part of a $12 million government effort to restore wolves to the American Rockies. Biologists say they're not surprised that the Yellowstone wolves did not bolt to freedom when their pen was opened. They were placed in the acre-sized enclosure 2 months ago after being captured in Canada. Eight others in other pens will be released after the first group disperses. Biologists hope the wolves have acclimated to their new home, making it less likely, perhaps, that they'll leave Yellowstone and attack cattle and sheep. The wolves wear radio collars so their movements can be monitored. 15 other wolves were released directly into the wild in Idaho in January. One was shot and killed when it was found eating a calf. Ranchers have tried to stop the wolf program. There are still efforts in Congress and Western state legislatures to restrict it. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
The Associated Press is quoting Senate sources who say ethics committee members will start reviewing evidence gathered in a probe of Oregon Senator Bob Packwood. Panel members are to be briefed on a staff report setting out evidence accumulated over the past 2 years. This includes information from Packwood's personal diaries. He is accused of making unwanted sexual advances toward more than 24 women. He is also accused of using his influence with lobbyists to help his ex-wife get a job. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lita Mahuri, is the director of Once Were Warriors, a new film from New Zealand. It's broken box office records there, surpassing even Jurassic Park. The film is about family violence in a Maori housing project. The Maoris are Polynesians who settled New Zealand before the country was colonized by Europeans. The Maoris of Once Were Warriors have lost touch with their ethnic culture and live in an urban culture of poverty and violence. New York Times film critic Janet Maslin said Once Were Warriors is ferocious, social realism with a savage kick. The Village Voice described its depiction of family violence as hard to watch, but even more difficult to look away from. Once Were Warriors is director Lita Mahuri's first feature. He says the film is about the consequences of alienation, what happens when an indigenous people is colonized and when a rural culture is transplanted to an urban ghetto.
The film deals with a post-Second World War urban alienation of an essentially rural culture that has split away from its origins and its roots and now become completely disoriented and dysfunctional, awash in alcohol and social welfare dependency and children growing up not having any sense of identity, and that breeding the seeds of disaster, really.
And a lot of violence.
A lot of violence because no outlets for what are essentially what were once a very proud race of men now reduced to queues of unemployed, large, tough men with a lot of alcohol and a certain amount of disposable income to spend it on. It's not an uncommon story around the planet.
Now, I believe your father is Maori and your mother white.
Mm-hmm.
Did you grow up in or near to the kind of urban, alienated culture that you describe in your film?
Yeah, very close to it, but not in it. My father was part of a kind of a new vanguard of young, educated Maori who was sent from who were educated and sent to the cities to essentially look after other Maori coming into the cities, find them employment, sort out problems that they had. And the emerging suburbs in the 1960s, 50s and 60s, were large. They were never called ghettos. They were models of new suburbia. But, of course, that was all working class. We lived on the periphery of that, but not in it. And we were, I guess, you know, my upbringing was more of a kind of almost white middle class upbringing. We were in a kind of very, very white suburb, so... I didn't experience it firsthand, but I saw a lot of it. My father's was in welfare, in specifically Maori welfare, which is a separate unit of the welfare division. And so he would spend all his time sorting out other people's domestic problems, essentially. So we used to see the kind of results of it, but we're never kind of attached to it.
Did he maintain connections to Maori traditions, and did he pass any of that on to you?
Very much so, but no. The saddest thing is he never passed it on to us because it's an interesting thing. It's almost something I could never talk to him about because of this thing about him becoming kind of the new wave. The new wave in the 50s and 60s, it was seen to be assimilate with the predominant culture and retain what you have about your own culture. And the saddest thing was that at that point in the development of Maori culture, it was seen more advantageous to assimilate with the white culture of the day and kind of just become part of it rather than retain your own identity and travel as two cultures. That's all changed now. The 70s and the 80s brought around a huge resurgence of pride in being Maori and a celebration of the culture itself through language and other things.
So what was the culture, or what is the culture? That's a really big question.
Yeah,
I know
is.
Most Americans are totally unfamiliar with Maori culture.
Maori, part of Polynesia, part of a huge Polynesian people that drift from anywhere from Hawaii to right down to New Zealand through all the archipelagos and islands of Tahiti and the Cook Islands. And they settled in New Zealand, or Aotearoa as it was called by Maori, somewhere around, vaguely around the year 1000, I guess. So they've been there for nearly 1,000 years and have developed a kind of very, very refined culture, both spiritual and otherwise, a very warlike culture, very tribal, a very, very strong sense of family, ancestry, where you come from, who you are. Very important to know these things. To be Maori is to know exactly who everybody is that came before you. You're supposed to be able to stand up and recite all that. It's a very unlike European culture. Very spiritual people, very humorous people. And very musical and very performance-oriented people, too.
In your movie, Once We're Warriors, there's a lot of scenes of violence. Violence in bars between men. The couple in your film, the man beats his wife mercilessly. Mm-hmm. And I think those violence scenes are really well directed. Now, I know you've said that you admired directors Sam Peckinpah, Martin Scorsese, Sergio Leone. They've all directed films with violence in them, and I was wondering if their different approaches to violence affected the way you portrayed it on screen.
No, not really. Much as I admire those guys and the films they made because of their kind of hard-edged cinematic realism, I admire so many filmmakers from Kurosawa to Pontecorvo to everywhere right across the board, even, you know, right up to today, you know, with, you know, it doesn't matter. There's so many people I admire. When you come to do something like violence in the cinema, you know, every project is different, and this one had a specific thing about it which said that you could not do violence as entertainment. It had to be, this was anti-violence, this was violence in the service of non-violence. So in doing that, I just kind of had to create something I hadn't seen before, which was essentially as brutally realistic a form of violence as anyone could take, without weaponry, without guns, knives or anything. So what I came down to was trying to represent a form of what I call street fighting or barroom brawling that no one's really quite seen before, because they've become too accustomed to seeing either American or other international product where barroom brawls are reduced to the form of a farce, where people get hit with chairs and they break and people slug it out. And, you know, it's kind of almost a comedy of manners now. And I thought, you know, in order for this violence to be repellent, he really had to show it as it was, as I've seen it up close. And anyone that's ever seen it happen like this knows that it's accurate. It's ruthlessly fast. It's over within seconds. And someone's unconscious on the floor in a pool of blood. So it was just a matter of trying to find a new way to do that.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things I felt watching the film was impact. I mean, the sense of impact. When a blow connected, you felt the impact. You felt the pressure.
That's
you heard it.
Yeah, it pushes you around the theater. You know, we really tried to. I tried to get that effect so that you felt it in your solar plexus. You could feel the, you know, this thing coming out of the screen at you, and it even did it to me when I watch it. Maybe not so much now, but for many times after I finished it, it would do that. You'd feel it very, very physically. It's a film that moves you about.
So tell me how you worked with the actors to get the violence that's fast and that has impact and that feels that's really uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah, well, what you have to do is, I mean, it's pretty simple. Everyone's read the script. We all know what's going on in there. We read these scenes. We, you know, as far as I just told all the actors, there's no way we're going to, this is going to be anything other than as brutally as honest and as real as we can put it on film. In doing that, then we go into standard cinematic techniques of fight arranging. You know, you get a stunt coordinator, and I tell them what I want and how I want it done. Then we organize it with the actors. I didn't want any stunt doubles or anything like that. I wanted the actors to do it all themselves, and because I think audiences are a little sophisticated and they know when the wool's been pulled over their eyes. And the other trick, of course, is where you put the camera. And I decided to go for an approach that didn't contain a lot of cuts, so to speak. The more cuts you put in a fight sequence, I think people know subliminally when they watch it, they know that there's some trickery going on. The more you can let a scene of violence unfold in one shot or two shots, it seems more terrifyingly real somehow, especially when you see the actual actors in there doing it themselves. So the scene with, of course, where the husband beats his wife up has a terrifying reality to it, because it's very finely tuned and the actors are doing it themselves at speed in real time. No slow motion, no nonsense, and the camera is positioned like a kind of fly on the wall, you know, where you're right there amongst it.
So where did you see the kind of violence you wanted to pattern
your
film on?
I grew up, as a young man, that whole pub environment, the bar environment that those guys inhabit is very much my upbringing. That's very much, I knew all that because I lived in it for 10, 12 years or more. In New Zealand, we have the most appalling social drinking habits in the world. And I don't want to go into the depth of why that came about, but there's many reasons for it. And growing up as a young man, any kind of, you know, fraternity of young men, you eventually end up, you know, drinking alcohol and driving cars and laughing your head off and having a great time until something very bad happens, like you get beaten up or you smash a car and you suddenly have to reflect on life. So I did a lot of that kind of hard drinking and I saw a lot of that violence around me. But I'm not that sort of guy, you know, I've never hit anyone in my life. I kind of tended to avoid it because I have a natural cowardly streak in me, so... But when you see it at close range, you know how awful it is, and yeah, I saw a lot of it.
Well, you know, in the movie, you'd learn which were the characters that were the most volatile, and that when they went off, they'd really go off.
Mm.
Did you see that in Friends of Yours, that you knew there were certain characters who
Oh, yeah, and you could, and you knew, and you almost... See, this is the thing that happens, and I think men all over the world relate to this. That bar environment you'll find from Glasgow to New Orleans... New Zealand is no exception to it. Groups of men, tough guys, or people who believe they're tough guys in bars, you know, drinking, a combination of alcohol and braggadocio inevitably leads to people like the Jake Hickeys of the world, people who are admired for their physical strength and their ability to deal out punishment to other people. So those people collect around them acolytes and other friends who are not so strong because they know the other guy will take care of trouble should it occur in their bar. So it's as old as time itself. It's primal. And it still goes on.
Now, Jake, who's the husband in the film, is he's a really interesting actor. I mean, I've never seen him before, but he has he's really solidly built, and he has these really wide arms, and it's all muscle.
It's all a trick, of course.
And there's something actually in his performance that reminded me of Marlon Brando.
Yep, Stanley Kowalski.
Stanley Kowalski, exactly.
Yeah, that's what I based him on.
Oh, okay. Mm. Because you know, I saw the restored version of Streetcar Named Desire recently, and the way Brando plays Stanley Kowalski is that he's really physical, he's always beating up his woman, but there's something underneath it, some sensitivity you see underneath.
That's right.
And some sexual charisma, too, that you at least understand the attraction. And it's the same way with Jake, the husband character
exactly
in your movie.
Exactly the same. I'm glad you spotted it. A lot of people don't, but it is exactly that. And that's where I was trying to take him, you know, that had he just played this violent, abusive husband, he would have been a one-dimensional character, and I really wanted the audience to know or understand something of his plight as well as what made him this kind of guy, what motivated him. And he had to be all those things, kind of electrifyingly sexy or sensual, dangerously violent, completely screwed up psychologically, all these things, you know, and I think he did an admirable job of it.
I have one last question for you. We talked about how you tried to show violence in a way that you hadn't seen it shown before. Mm. And it's really quite impressive. And I can see you, I can imagine you getting a lot of offers from Hollywood now for action films.
Mm.
For films that are much more just about, you know, like action and violence. And it's more for entertainment value than anything else. Would you take on a film like that?
I would. I'm actually sort of doing one at the moment, but it's not what I call an action film. It's kind of like a period thriller, more like a Chinatown than anything. Those are the films I like. I've already said, yes, I've had all those offers, but I actually don't want to do Steven Seagal movies or Die Hard 6, 7, and 8 and all that stuff. I think there's no end of hungry young directors who want to get out there and show their stuff and how they can, you know, get on a Steadicam and run around and do all this extraordinary stuff. There's nothing wrong with that. I like it. I like watching it. It's kind of cathartic to me, but it's becoming very much a kind of, you know, a blah. It's all becoming very much the same. You know, how many pyrotechnics can you see? How many cars can you see explode? I mean, come on, please. You know, I really, you know, they're great. They're amusing. They're good value. But every now and again, one comes along like the original Die Hard or the original Lethal Weapon. These are great. You know, the original 48 Hours. You know, these are exceptionally good action movies which recreate the genre and keep it fresh and alive. Then there's 50 imitators that come along and follow it. And then people like me are asked to direct them. Well, sorry, folks, I don't want to do them. But I do want to do what I call, you know, sophisticated American genre pictures, much like one that I'm doing now, which are very, very dark, deal with, you know, they're full of actors for once, to start with, but they're about human frailty and conflict between human beings and people, you know, what happens when people are pushed to limits or stress levels where they break. The kind of Alan Pakula's Sidney Lumet type of very dark, interesting stuff, but occasionally goes hand in glove with exceptionally good action sequences.
Lita Mohori, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Lita Mohori is the director of the new film Once Were Warriors, and in a moment we'll meet the star of the film, Raina Owen. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Raina Owen, is the star of the new film Once Were Warriors. She plays Beth, who lives with her husband and five children in a Maori housing project in New Zealand. Beth has been married for 18 years and seems to love her husband, although he's become an alcoholic and he brutally beats her. New York Times film critic Janet Maslin wrote this about Owen's depiction of Beth. She's not simply a victim. Ms. Owen, a fiery actress with the sad, sensual look of a Hard Knocks Jean Moreau, radiates a physical vitality that makes sense of this union. Actress Raina Owen grew up in Maori culture. Her father was Maori, her mother white.
My mother married my father's in the 50s when it was a no-no, still for white people to marry Maori people, so she was disowned by her family. So therefore we knew nothing of the English side of my heritage, so I very much grew up on the Maori side. My father's from the place I come from, Kawiti, and of course I grew up very much around the extended family with my grandmother, who was like the matriarch, central figure in our family, and it was a huge family. She'd had 15 children, and of course in my own family there were 9 children. And I very much grew up around the marae, which is like the meeting place, which you see at during Grace's funeral in the film. We didn't grow up with the language, however. That was the one thing we did miss out on for the same reasons as Lee. It's actually a good example of the language. I mean, my father was a native fluent speaker and a beautiful speaker of the language. But in their childhoods, in the 20s and the 30s, they were forced to go to school. And they were actually whipped for speaking their native tongue. This was the way they were forced to speak English. So therefore, they never passed the language on to our generation, which is why we're sort of known as the lost generation in a way.
Are there traditions that you have kept in your life?
Yeah, well, I grew up from, I suppose it was my first encounter of the entertainment business as soon as I could walk. I learned traditional Māori singing and dancing, and I very much grew up on what we call it kapahaka. And I continued with that throughout college, which is how I got into drama, into my first stage production at the age of 15 years old as Bloody Mary in South Pacific, and then Calamity Jane and Calamity Jane. And those breaks were as a result of me being in the Māori Culture Club. I also obviously grew up with...
Wait, what is kapahaka?
Kapahaka is the traditional Māori singing and dancing.
Ah.
You see a little glimpse of it in the male dance called the haka, which you see in the film, and you see our All Blacks doing before the beginning of a rugby match. The other things I suppose I grew up with, well, as I said earlier, I grew up very much around the marae. We'd have to go to a lot of the huis, what we call huis, which are like gatherings, whether they're for funerals or weddings or for conferences or meetings or what have you. And of course, I grew up with all the food, like our traditional hangis and puha and pork bones and what have you. And I very much grew up around an extended family. Yeah, so my background was very rich in Māori tanga.
How did being Māori influence the kind of roles that you were offered once you started to act professionally?
Well, it didn't. In London, I could play anything. It wasn't an issue. I mean, I was just seen as an actress, which is obviously what I prefer. I only encountered that when I went back to New Zealand, where I would only get looked at for Māori roles. And so I'd go along and they'd say, oh, no, but you're too European looking. So I'd go along for a European part and it'd be like, well, you look slightly Māori. So I found that very frustrating and very small-minded and very limiting in a way. In fact, in England, I was better off because I could play anything. I wasn't seen as anything. I was just seen as an actress because I've got very pale skin.
What's the movie industry in New Zealand like now, and how many opportunities are there for actors?
Limited. I mean, it's why I predominantly do stage work. Camera opportunities are very rare. We make anything from 1 to 3 films per year in New Zealand, and you're obviously not going to always be right for the roles. Television, you know, anything from 2 TV series per year, some half-hour dramas. It's limited. Camera work is very limited. Obviously, it's a very small, it's lowly funded business. So, yeah, I tend to spend most of my time in the theatre.
What do your older relatives think of you being an actress?
Oh, they're obviously very proud, particularly obviously too, because Warriors has had a huge success and they're very happy for me, definitely. In fact, they're the main support of my life, really.
What are some of the more personal reactions you've gotten from filmgoers in New Zealand who've seen Once Were Warriors?
The responses I've had have all been incredibly positive, quite phenomenal. But the reactions, well, particularly a lot of letters and fan mail, have been more from your average Joe blogs, basically, not necessarily film buffs. People like women and young teenagers write to me and, you know, telling me that they were a Beth or they were a Grace or how the film had been very healing and very empowering for them. In general, I think for the Māori people in New Zealand, that's the effect it has had. It's really empowered our people tremendously. And, of course, the social impact of the film has been incredible. I mean, two weeks to a month after it was released in New Zealand, the helplines, the lifelines were inundated with callers. Women's refuge groups were overflowing, anger management group, men against violence, with basically women and men, not just Māori, Pākehā white as well, going along and saying, I've got a warrior's problem. So the film has become quite a part of the nation's psyche, and it's given people license, or a keyword, if you'd like to say, to talking about what's actually happening in their own lives. So, you know, for an actress, I feel very spoilt, actually, for my sort of first lead in my first major feature film to have been such a success at the box office, and also to have changed people's lives is quite an achievement.
Raina Owen is the star of the new film Once Were Warriors. I'm Cherie Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Living Language. Learn a new language at home or on the go with Living Language. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a physician undergoes emergency surgery, which leads her to rethink the relationship of doctor and patient. We talk with Dr. Jody Hyman, who now teaches a course at Harvard Medical School on the doctor-patient relationship. She's written a new book on the subject called Equal Partners. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a tribute album to songwriter Doc Pomus. Pomus died in 1991. He wrote hits for Elvis Presley, Dion, and the Drifters. Some of the singers paying tribute to him are Lou Reed, Bob Dylan, and Roseanne Cash. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A former postal employee is the man charged in the New Jersey post office shootings. A federal complaint says Christopher Green has been charged with robbing the Montclair post office and killing four people and wounding a fifth. The complaint says Green has confessed. The United States has expressed concern again about Iran's military buildup in the Persian Gulf. UPI's Bill Small prepared this report.
President Clinton reacted mildly last month to Iran's stationing of Hawk anti-aircraft missiles at the mouth of the Persian Gulf, Mr. Clinton calling the missiles old and no cause for concern. Now Defense Secretary William Perry says Iran has also stationed 6,000 troops and chemical weapons. White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry.
Secretary Perry did suggest that they could present a potential threat to shipping there, but so far, there's no indication that it is other than a defensive deployment.
McCurry says Iran is aware of the U.S. interest in protecting shipping in the Gulf and its determination to defend what it considers a vital national interest. Bill Small at the White House.
Japanese police have confiscated drums of chemicals after raiding several sites of a secretive religious sect earlier today. One of the chemicals was detected in Monday's gassing of the Tokyo subway system. That attack killed 10 people and injured more than 5,000. The BBC's Katty Kay has this report from Tokyo.
The raid was a military-style operation involving some 3,000 police, many of whom wore gas masks. In the chapel at Om Shinrikyo's offices outside Tokyo, they found about 50 people lying dehydrated and malnourished. But police still haven't arrested any members of the sect in connection with Monday's attack, although four senior followers were charged today with confining people against their will. During the morning raid of the buildings, police also discovered dozens of bottles of a liquid believed to be the type of solvent used in the underground attack. The solvent, acetonitrile, can be used to dilute the nerve gas sarin and was detected inside trains and stations after Monday's attacks. Police also confiscated two other chemicals, chloroform and ethanol, along with piles of gas masks.
Caddy Kay reporting. California authorities say farm damage in the northern part of that state has reached $400 million. State officials say most of the damage is in Monterey County. That's known as America's Salad Bowl. Lettuce crops took the worst beating. They sustained more than $70 million in damage. Meanwhile, weather forecasters say a new cold front is moving into California. It is expected to bring snow, but not enough rain to aggravate the flooding. On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 10 points to end the day at 4,082. Declining issues led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. The price of an average share gained 3 cents. This is NPR. The Midwest remains the country's most affordable region when it comes to purchasing a home. The National Association of Home Builders' latest survey says Lima, Ohio is the nation's most affordable housing market. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
For the second straight quarter, Lima led the survey. San Francisco once again came in last place on the affordability list of 183 metropolitan areas, a distinction it's held since the quarterly surveys began in early 1991. The least affordable markets in the other regions were Chicago in the Midwest, New York in the Northeast, and El Paso, Texas in the South. Lima registered an 88.4 on the Home Builders Association Opportunity Index, meaning that a family earning a median income of $38,600 could afford to buy 80% of the homes sold during the quarter. San Francisco registered an 18 on the index. Association President Jim Irvine says the survey confirms that housing affordability has been somewhat diminished over the past 2 years by rising mortgage rates. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
A new study suggests a pill for lowering cholesterol makes good medical and economic sense. Researchers have found that heart patients given the drug simvastatin cut their hospital admissions by one-third during 5 years of treatment. The $2 pill also cut the number of days patients needed to be hospitalized. It also reduced the need for heart bypass surgery and angioplasty. The Scandinavian Survival Study looked at some 4,400 volunteers. A newspaper has published findings from an undercover audit on top stock brokerages and their treatment of women customers. The San Francisco Chronicle reports women customers tend to get poorer treatment than men do. The audit was conducted by the group Profit Market Research and Consulting. The group studied 300 brokers at 21 national and regional firms in December and January. The report says men routinely receive more information than women do, and women are twice as likely not to be asked about their investment history, which is important when picking different financial packages. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. Jody Hyman learned about medicine at Harvard Medical School. But right after she graduated, she learned something medical school hadn't taught her: how confused and helpless patients often feel. She learned this the hard way by becoming a patient. It was just after graduation that she had a seizure in the middle of the night. The seizure was caused by a blood vessel that broke and caused her to bleed into her brain. That led to brain surgery, paralyzing pain, hallucinations, and months of slow recuperation. She's recovered now and teaches courses at Harvard Medical School on the patient-doctor relationship and healthcare policy. She's written a new memoir about her experiences as patient and doctor called Equal Partners. Her first bad experience as a patient happened the night of her first seizure, when the ambulance came and the paramedics assumed she was a drug addict.
As is common after generalized seizures, I was confused. I didn't know what was going on, but my husband was quite aware. He's a physician. He told the ambulance drivers, "I'm a physician. She had a seizure. We need this kind of medication." And he was treated like I was a drug addict. He asked what kind of drugs are you taking? He said, "None." They kept repeatedly asking him and wouldn't believe that I wasn't taking drugs. And all the way to the hospital, really ignored his requests for medical help based on his medical knowledge of the situation.
So how did their assumption that you were taking drugs affect the care that you were given that night?
Well, I think one of the important ways it affected is no one explained to me what was going on, so I was terribly confused. As far as I was concerned, strangers were coming and taking me out of my bed. I had no idea what had happened, and taking me to a foreign place, roped down my arms and legs, and no one bothered to say the simple words that really would have helped a great deal. You had a seizure. We're here with an ambulance. We're here to help you.
Do you have any idea what caused you to bleed into your brain?
Yeah, what I had was a cavernous hemangioma, which is just a set of abnormal blood vessels, and we don't really know much as physicians about why they tend to bleed when someone enters their late 20s or early 30s, but that's a common time for them to bleed.
Your doctor recommended surgery, and you had to decide whether to have it or not. You write that your father tried to help you decide because, after all, he teaches methods of rational decision-making to graduate students. So with his help guiding you through rational decision-making, did you have enough information to make what qualifies as a rational decision about having surgery?
No, it really was dramatic, both to my father and I. He had taught decision-making in the past, and I had taken decision-making courses. Of course, in all those courses, we deal as if we have certain knowledge. So we say, what are the chances of different things happening? What are the benefits? What are the risks of surgery? But in fact, the surgeons really had very little idea about all of those. We got three different opinions. And all three surgeons, although they all recommended the surgery and felt quite strongly it was important, they all had different beliefs about what would be the outcome and what would be the benefits.
What were you told would happen with the surgery as opposed to what actually happened?
I was told it lasts about an hour and a half, and that it would be simple to find the hemangioma because it was on the surface of my brain. In fact, it took them 10 hours, and at the end, they weren't sure whether they'd gotten it or not. That was the first thing. The second is that I was told by two out of the three surgeons that would decrease the chance of seizures, and in fact, I continued to have seizures afterwards. To their credit, they were all giving me the information to their best of their knowledge, and I think the most we can ask of physicians is that they share with us their level of uncertainty.
You had a lot of side effects that you were unprepared for after your surgery.
I did. I think I was unprepared for how they would handle the pain after the surgery. It's a tremendous amount of pain, and it was inadequately managed. That's something that's commonly a problem in our healthcare system. I was given medications too widely apart for them to work. My husband, a physician, tried to get one of the nurses to contact a physician so that I could have more frequent doses of medication, but she was unwilling. And unfortunately, this is a tragedy that's repeated frequently in our healthcare system, that people don't get pain medication in a way that's effective. The second thing that's happened that's described in the book is hallucinations, which I had. No one had warned me about the possibility of hallucinations afterwards, but worse yet, when I asked physicians what these were and how long they would last, what they were caused by, I was told that nobody had any idea. That in itself was just terrifying because it meant that I had no idea whether I'd gone crazy. Later on, patients told me that, in fact, these were very common. And that left me to surmise that if the physicians had been talking to patients, listening to their experiences, then they would be able to know and to share with other patients, this is common, this won't last forever.
You had a pretty horrendous experience with your surgery. It took 10 hours as opposed to the 90 minutes you were told to expect. You had terrible side effects that you were unprepared for. And that, you know, that the doctors did not predict were going to happen. And then to make matters worse, you were told, well, you're probably going to have a second operation because we missed some of the hemangioma. You sought a second opinion, and the second doctor said, you don't need it. You don't need the surgery. In fact, there's no more hemangioma left.
Yeah, it was really just chance in some respect that we got a second opinion. I had been ready to go ahead for the second surgery and then got profoundly ill in the hospital. I was having brain swelling that led to constant vomiting. There was a medication I'd been given intravenously to take care of the brain swelling. They then stopped the medication and gave it to me by mouth. But because I was vomiting every 1 to 5 minutes, I couldn't keep the medicine down. I spent hours trying to convince the resident on call to do what really should have been routine care, which is put me back on a medication intravenously that would work. In the end, I had to get my husband, a physician, in after 12 hours to intervene and get me the medication that worked and immediately took care of the brain swelling and the aseptic meningitis. That whole episode made us rethink diving ahead. And that's when we went to get a second opinion. Had that not happened, I probably would have had a second needless operation.
Dr. Jody Hyman is my guest, and she's the author of a new book called Equal Partners. And the book is a memoir about the period right after she graduated from Harvard Medical School, when she bled into her brain and had surgery and a long period of recovery afterwards. She now teaches at Harvard Medical School. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Jody Hyman, And her new memoir, Equal Partners, is about the practice of medicine and about her experiences as a patient after she bled into her brain and had a very serious brain operation. Your book is called Equal Partners, and you use that title because you think patient and doctor should be equal partners when there is an illness. In what sense should they be equal partners?
Well, I think physicians make a big mistake by assuming that because they know more microbiology or they know more anatomy than patients, that they know much more and that they can't be equal partners. In fact, patients know far more about what it's like to live with an illness, what the symptoms are like, what they need in terms of balancing their life goals with dealing with the symptoms they have from their illness, what they need in terms of treatment. So really the two bring complementary but different things to what should be an equal partnership in decision making.
Were you often given the status of equal partner in your relationship with your doctors when you were sick?
Well, the book describes what happened to me and what happens to a number of other patients. And in fact, although sometimes we are treated as equal partners, and certainly there are wonderful physicians providing care that way, all too often, in my case and in that of other patients, symptoms we had were not believed or we were not incorporated in our own care.
Did you have symptoms that you felt were overlooked?
The spring before I had the brain surgery, I had had increasingly severe headaches and had called a physician about the headaches. I was told that they were probably stress. And as the headaches got worse, I called back again and was told again stress. And I said, well, I do lead a stressed life, but I don't think it's any more stress this year than any other year. And was just told, well, again, don't worry about it. You have children, you're in medical school, it's probably just stress. I think that kind of disbelieving or undervaluing patients' symptoms is very frequent and frequently leads to problems.
You know, hearing you talk about what you were up against when you were sick, everybody else must be wondering, well, what are their chances of really understanding what's happening? Because you, after all, had just gotten out of Harvard Medical School. So when you talk about being an equal partner with your doctor, you were much more equipped to be afforded that position than someone who didn't have medical training.
I was, but nonetheless, my voice was often ignored, as in the case I described where I had the constant vomiting. It really didn't matter that I was a physician. When I was in medical school, I had heard a story about a patient who was in a New York hospital emergency room with a heart attack, tried to be seen, telling him how seriously sick he was, couldn't be seen for hours, and in the end called an ambulance to the emergency room to take him to another hospital. At the time I heard this story, I thought it was apocryphal. I couldn't believe it happened. And after my experiences, seeing what's like, how you're treated, whether you are a physician yourself or whether you're a patient who's not a physician, I realize that often it's like talking underwater. You can speak as long as you want, but nobody's listening and no one can hear.
How do you think your work as a doctor was changed by your experiences as a patient?
When I went back to be a resident after this episode, my work was really dramatically changed in a number of ways. I think the first way is, while I had always believed patients' experience, it threw even more weight on the side of believing patients' experiences. Just to give one example, I took care of a child who had terrible neck pain, disabling enough that she was missing more and more school. She'd been seen for several years, and more doctors disbelieved her because they couldn't find the problem. And I think because of my experiences, I understood that when we can't find problems as physicians, it doesn't mean they're not there. I got her into further diagnostic workup. We examined her, and in fact, she had a problem with her cervical spine. Other ways in which it changed were just understanding the importance of families in the care and what the impact is on families. The book tells the experiences of my families and some other patients' families, but clearly it's a dramatic life event to go through having a loved one that's sick. And as in my recuperation, for many people, our families play a vital role. So When a patient I took care of had meningitis, I spent a lot of time up at night talking to her family, reassuring her family, being as honest as I could about what we knew and answering their questions. Again, I'm sure I would have done that before, but the weight I placed on involving the family was different.
For a physician who is really dedicated, and they follow the same philosophy you did, that the patient and doctor should be equal partners, a lot of time should be spent in discussing symptoms, discussing reactions to medicine. Are there barriers that prevent a doctor from actually doing it?
There are two major barriers that prevent doctors from doing it. One is the problem of time, and that comes in every aspect. It comes in that patients are discharged sooner from the hospital when they're sicker. Insurers often don't let physicians follow up with those patients. When they're on an outpatient basis, as we've discussed, the appointments are far too short to discuss health issues. The second is that physicians often aren't given a choice as to what kind of treatments they can recommend. Insurers are playing an increasing role, limiting what choices the physician can recommend, and that in turn means the physician doesn't even offer the patient what are all the options. That's for the physician who's trying. Even more concerning for the patient is those physicians who this isn't a primary concern for them. Health insurers are increasingly using economic incentives that the physician's pay will be tied to whether or not they order an X-ray or order a lab test. And that just makes it less and less possible for patients to know that their physician will give them an honest, open-minded view of what the best options are.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Jody Hyman's new memoir is called Equal Partners. She teaches at Harvard Medical School. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We'll have a report, Terry, from Julie McCarthy, who is stationed in Japan, on the nerve gas problem that they had in the subways there. She has more on where the nerve gas came from and a look at the group, which is believed to have had something to do with putting the nerve gas into the subway, which has caused a number of deaths, and the death toll continues to rise. We have Tom Jelton's report on war crimes in former Yugoslavia and a poll on tax cuts. Apparently, the American people are telling pollsters that they're not sure that a tax cut is what they want now.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jerome Felder, a Brooklyn native crippled by polio at the age of 6, turned himself into Doc Pomus, a revered songwriter who wrote such hits as Viva Las Vegas, Turn Me Loose, Save the Last Dance for Me, I Count the Tears, and This Magic Moment. Pomus died in 1991. A new CD called Till the Night Is Gone pays tribute to him. His songs are interpreted by a wide range of performers, including B.B. King, Lou Reed, Los Lobos, Solomon Burke, and Bob Dylan. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
She wears loafer shoes, dungarees, red checkered shirt, if you please. She's my boogie, woogie, boogie, woogie, boogie, woogie country girl. But I mean what I mean, my boogie, woogie country girl.
When I was starting out as a music critic, I lived in Manhattan and went to hear a lot of music in a lot of clubs. I soon began to notice that one regular on the club scene was a huge bearded man in a wheelchair who often wore a Panama hat with a big feather in it. As often as not, the headliner of the show would come over and say hello to this imposing figure, so I knew he was someone important. When a colleague told me this was Doc Pomus, I must admit that I wasn't initially impressed. Callow youth that I was, I knew Doc Pomus as, what, the author of some hits for the Drifters and a few Elvis Presley songs, including one that I thought was pretty silly, Viva Las Vegas. All I can do now is acknowledge my ignorance and apologize for it.
Turn me loose. Turn me loose, I say. This is the first time I ever felt this way. I'm gonna get a thousand kicks. Kiss a thousand chicks, so turn me loose. I'll say, go rock and roll along at the bank.
Dion's wonderful performance of Turn Me Loose captures perfectly what made Doc Pomus a great pop songwriter. Lyrics that sound conversational and aphoristic at the same time, melodies whose artful twists and turns seem inevitable the first time you hear them. Pomus said his life was most influenced by the blues, and he wrote his share of great ones, like Lonely Avenue and There Must Be a Better World Somewhere, which is exquisitely interpreted by Irma Thomas here. But Doc Pomus probably achieved his greatest effects in his pop ballads. The purest of these is probably Save the Last Dance for Me, sung here by Aaron Neville.
You can dance, every dance with the guy who gives you the eye, let him hold you tight. You can smile, every smile for the man who held your hand beneath the pale moonlight. But don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, save the last dance for me.
Doc Pomus was the sort of craftsman who didn't call attention to his own cleverness. That's one reason why he could churn out both personal work like Turn Me Loose and movie soundtrack fluff like Viva Las Vegas, a song, by the way, that I've come to like more and more as I get older, and which receives a marvelously eccentric interpretation by Sean Colvin here. If Till the Night Is Gone manages to introduce a new wave of listeners to Doc Pomus's work, it'll be doing pop music a big favor. I wish, years ago, I'd walked over to him in a dimly lit nightclub and shaken his hand.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Till the Night Is Gone, a tribute to Doc Pomus on Rhino Records. Finally, in the Department of Corrections, yesterday our TV critic David Bianculli said that he had low expectations for the new TV series Hope and Gloria. He meant to say the series Pride and Joy. I'm Terry Gross, and we'll go out with Solomon Burke singing Doc Pomus's Still in Love.
You love me, then you left me, and now you're laughing. You're laughing because I'm in love with you. You hurt me.
You hurt me.
And you use me.
And use me.
So many times.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Darling, you send me.
On the next Fresh Air, we pay tribute to the late Sam Cooke with the author of a new biography and the founder of the Soul Stirrers, the gospel group with which Cooke launched his career. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.